Hey everybody, I'm Jan, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm honored to be here. I'm honored to be asked to speak anywhere, but even if I was second choice, it's still an honor. I tease about that. I was able to answer the call, and I'm glad to do that. So, and it's always a pleasure to come here, and I appreciate the hospitality. I appreciate the golf today. That was nice. I had a good day. My sobriety date is April the 28th of 1997. So just a few days ago, I got to celebrate 18 years in this deal, and that's. I'm clapping for. Because it's not me, and I was telling Philip and Teresa, it's. I think I've gotten to that point in this deal where, somebody new is just not going to identify with me. I remember when I came in, and just early in sobriety, you look around the room, it's like somebody's got 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, you're like, that what? But somebody has 1 year, 2 years, you're like, okay, there's something I can aspire to. I could talk to that guy. But here I am, and still doing it. I'll try to tell you a little bit about what happened to me and what made me get sober and how I got sober. I will say this, on April the 28th of 1997, I walked into the Turning Point group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it wasn't the first time I'd been into that meeting, but that particular night, it was a speaker meeting, and the woman at the podium said, I always knew I was coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I just didn't know when. And that was exactly what I needed to hear that night, because this was another one of my trips into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, although it was a little bit different this time, and I'll get into that. Unlike Jen last night, the progression of the disease with me and drinking, it was slow. I almost missed it. I could have been somewhere else tonight if I had. That was a joke, y'all. No, seriously, when I was in high school and started drinking, it wasn't a big deal. It was just about having fun, and I didn't drink that much. I didn't drink that much differently than my friends did. I thought of this just the other day when I knew I was coming up here to speak and just thinking about things, and I remember 10th grade biology class. They had somebody come in and speak to us about alcohol, and they said, if you get drunk twice a year, you might be an alcoholic. And I remember thinking, I get drunk once a month, and I'm not an alcoholic. Just thinking back to those, to what I thought that it's funny today. But at any rate, I have to tell this in my story because it matters later. You know, when I grew up in a small town in Mississippi, it was a dry county, so it was always a deal to have to get something to drink. And the easiest thing to get, of course, was beer. I hated beer. I couldn't stand the taste of beer. It took me 40 minutes to drink a can of beer, and it had to be ice cold, or I just couldn't get it down. I liked whiskey, and I liked drinking it with Coke, sweeten it up, and that's what I like to drink. But that's what I did. It was just about having fun, and I will admit, I liked what alcohol did for me. It made me feel good. I felt a little bit bigger and a little bit badder, and it was definitely that social lubricant that we all seem to like, but I didn't really have any consequences, and I don't think I drank that much differently than my friends, like I said, but maybe I was the first one that said, hey, let's go get something to drink, but they were right there with me. I graduated high school and couldn't wait to get out of this little town, so I joined the service. Couldn't imagine going to college. I joined the Navy. And that was fun because even though I was underage, I was 17 when I went in, I could drink on base, so that was good. I could do that. That was fun. And, you know, you're going overseas then, and you can drink overseas wherever you want. And I look back on those days, and I think, man, I have been around the world a couple of times. I have been to a lot of different countries. And it would be nice to stand up and be able to talk to people about the different cultures I saw and all the different stuff that I experienced, but that's not what happened. You've heard, you know the cliche of what sailors do when they're in the port city. Well, that's what I did. I was a young, naive kid, and that's what I did. I drank and stuff. But you know what? There weren't a lot of consequences that came. And you know, when you're young, you can do that. You can drink half the night, and man, when you got to get up the next day, you can answer the bell because you're young, and that's just how it is. So that's what I did. Now, I drank a lot. I probably drank more than my friends did. And I wasn't a mean drunk. I was too little to be a mean drunk. It's not, you know, getting your butt kicked is not a good recipe for, so I was a happy drunk. But anyway, certain things would start to happen. I remember the ship would be in port, and we'd get in an apartment, me and my buddy, and we're living there, and we drank every day. But again, it wasn't so much because we had to, it's just because that's what we wanted to do. And I remember thinking, man, we drink a lot, and I told my roommate, you think we got a problem? Why? We should like stop this just to see if we can. So for 30 days, we decided we'd quit drinking, and we did. So I thought, well, we're great. We're good to go. We can go back to the bars, and that's what we did. No big deal, right? A few minor scrapes and stuff, but nothing real bad. Anybody in here who has multiple DUIs and stuff, you got some of mine, because I never got one. Don't ask me how. I deserved them, I promise. But I just, you know, when I talk to guys who have 8, I think, all right, you got some of mine. I got out of the service. I recommend you don't ever do this. I moved to a town where I didn't know anybody. I'm kind of an introvert. I'm not really out there able to make friends real easy, kind of quiet. The one thing I'm really good at, though, is drinking in a bar. That I can do. And so that becomes the center of my life, was finding a bar and getting to know those people and just going there every day. And that's what I did. Could have got my mail there. They could have had my name on the back of a chair. But that's what I did. And you know, maybe one day a week I didn't drink because I was usually just too sick. Just my body had enough. And so you had to recuperate one day. But it was all about having fun. And the idea of drinking alcoholically then just wasn't there. If I had a date with a girl, you know what? I could actually go out and have a drink or two and stop and not have to drink the rest of the evening. And so I know that people talk about, well, you can't catch alcoholism from sitting on a bar stool. And I don't debate any of that one way or the other. I don't know. I do know that at some point in my drinking, I crossed a line from which I could not return. But it wasn't then. I seemed like I could maintain. But I did like drinking, and it did make my life better at that point. At least it made me more comfortable with the world around me. So that's what I did. And I was having fun. I met a girl, and she had a lot of the answers that I was looking for in a girl, I guess. But she couldn't be here tonight. She hurt her back. She was all pumped and ready to go Thursday night. We were going to leave Friday. She went to work and hurt her back and had to stay home. But anyway, this girl, she had all the answers, and we started fooling around and decided we'd get married. She wanted to move out of this town in Missouri, and my parents were after me to kind of move closer to home. I hadn't been back since I left, so we got married and moved to Memphis the next day, and here we go. We set up house, and we're going to do it, and it was good for a little while. She could drink some, not like me, but she didn't mind drinking, and when I talk about the progression of the disease and how slow it is, this is where it starts. It starts with the simple little thing where you're getting ready to go out, and she says something like, you know, tonight I hope you don't drink as much as you did last time because you remember this happened, and well, that embarrassed me and it hurt my memory, whatever it was. And I'm like, oh, honey, I am so sorry. I didn't mean for that to happen. I'll be good tonight. And then you go out, and I may or may not get drunk, depending on that. It was early in those days, and I probably did good for a little while, but you know, then it was right back to it, and more things were happening. I remember somewhere along the line, you know, alcohol was becoming more a part of my life, but I didn't see it. The problem I had in my life was the person I was living with. I remember coming home from work, and I'd come down the street, and we had these hedges out in front of our house, and there was a point where you got to it and you saw whether or not she was home, whether her car was in the driveway. And when I'd get to that point, I'd just go, ugh. But I'd pull in and play nice and do whatever I had to do. At that time, I was my drinking was getting bad. We're starting to have fights. She's starting to call me names. I'm starting to call her names. They're not nice names. We're starting to struggle with this alcoholism thing. I don't have any idea it's alcohol. My problem is my wife, and that's just the way it was. But she's starting to complain more and more about my drinking. I remember we had gone to a wedding reception, and I was drinking too much, and she left. And I didn't come home till late, and she was really mad. I get the story out of order sometimes, but things were getting bad, and I was having to make it up to her, and I'd quit for 30 days to prove I could, and pretty soon I couldn't quit for 30 days. It was like, gosh, I didn't mean to quit 25 days before New Year's. So you have to drink on New Year's. So I'd, con my way in, and I would do that. But things were definitely getting bad. I come home from work one day, and she meets me at the door, and she says, "Guess what?" And I can tell by the look in her eye, we're going to have a baby. And, I never wanted kids. Good God, the house I grew up in with the dysfunction, I didn't think I'd be a good parent. The home I grew up in, there was all kinds of abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, just you name it. It was not a fun place to grow up. But at that time, I was old enough, and I thought, okay, I could do this. We can try this. We'll be parents, and let's go ahead. And 9 months later, my daughter was born. And I have to tell you this. She's 3 weeks old. I'm sitting in the back porch on the swing, swinging her. And the most incredibly powerful feeling just washes over me. I knew exactly what it was, unconditional love. And I felt even just a little bit sad at that moment because I thought, you know what, you can't put this feeling into words. She will never know how much her daddy loves her because there's no way to express that. But fast forward 10 months, my wife is working out of the house on the weekends, and so she leaves in the morning. I have to take care of our daughter. So I start drinking as soon as my wife's out of the house. And then later on in the day, people talked about passing out. I didn't call it passing out. I had to take a nap. So that's what I did. I'd lay down and take a nap on the couch. And I remember I would wake up and I'd have to look for her. I remember finding her asleep underneath the dining room table, where I'd find her in her bedroom just sitting on the floor playing. And that thought would go through my head, Jan, when did you feed her last? When did you change her diaper last? When did you play with her last? And I thought, oh man, this is not the kind of dad I want to be. I love my daughter, but this is how I'm treating her. And that hurts because I tell you, the kind of home I grew up in, it was not like that. I mean, my dad loved us. I know he did. He just had a tough, he didn't know how. So at any rate, I'm having to hide this stuff. I got pretty good on the weekends. My wife would be gone for so long, I'd have taken my nap and got back up, got everything situated. Well, she's going to be home in about a half an hour, so I can start drinking again now. Because by the time she gets home, hey, I'm just on my second beer. Remember I told you I didn't like beer? Well, things have changed. The way my drinking is in this day and age, at this time, and we're fighting so much, I basically have two choices. I can either go home and wait her out until she goes to bed and get something to drink, or I can just leave work and start drinking and not go home. That's kind of it. And depending on the day, I would make whatever choice. But she would come home and I'd go, oh, I'm just on my second beer. So okay, fine. And then I would proceed to get drunk and, we'd argue or not. There were a lot of things going on right then, and the fights were getting worse. I came home from work one day. My mom's car's in the driveway. My sister's car's in the driveway. My brother's car's in the driveway, and I knew right then, oh, geez, we're going to talk about Jan's drinking. And I go in, and yeah, okay, so you're causing problems, and you can't do this, and you're not doing this, and so I got invited to move down and stay with my mom. I was 37 years old, and I had to go live with my, and the locks on the house were changed. That really chapped my rear end. You know, I'm paying the mortgage here, but the locks are changed. I can't even go in. But I had a pretty good spirit about it. I thought, you know what? I'm going to go stay with my mom, and I'm going to turn over a new leaf, because guess what? I am away from my problem. So now I can start to live a life that I want where I'll be happy. So I go down there and start to stay sober. And, well, you know what happens when we try to white-knuckle it for a little while. We can't do that. And the next thing you know, I'm coming home from work. And so I get a drink. And now I'm sneaking around, hiding it from my mom. And I hated who I was again. You know, sometimes I think that the real pain that we alcoholics bring on ourselves, it's not all that stuff we do and the consequences. I think it's the stuff we do that just makes us hate and loathe ourselves inside. Just that stuff that we do that, you know, I'm feeling this tall. I know mom loves me like nobody else, but I can't even look her in the face because I'm a drunk. I don't want to admit that. I just think something else is going on. The family I grew up in, why you pulled yourself up from the bootstraps, you know, if there was something you needed, you just went to work and got it. You keep your shoulder to the wheel, your nose to the grindstone, and just achieve what you can. So anything that had to do with my drinking was just me not doing good enough, not managing enough. And so if there was a problem, I would have to figure out how am I going to fix this? I'll just have to do better. I just got to buckle down and try harder. And we're really good at talking our way back into the house, so I did that. And so we go along again, and I'm able to hide the drinking or not drink for a little while, then hide it a little while, and then she catches me again. Somewhere along this time, she started going to Al-Anon. And I am grateful for the program at Al-Anon, because it allowed her to start learning how to set some boundaries that really changed the dynamic in our house. And I always like to say, it wasn't the nights that I came home drunk that we had those big knockdown dragouts that were the problem. It was the nights that I came home and she didn't say anything. Those were the nights where I always felt like, uh-oh, the gig's about up here, so I better watch it. Drinking then was I didn't have a problem, but here's how you had to drink it. Here's how I had to drink in my house on those nights. I would wait her out. Finally, she would go to bed. Thank you, God. And I would wait about half an hour, and I would tiptoe down the hallway to the bedroom and look in, and yeah, she's in there just sawing logs. All right, the coast is clear. So you go back out, and I got to go out the front door. You got to open that door slow because it squeaks a little bit, and you just sneak outside, and then I'm off to get some beer. And I come back, you leave it out on the front porch because she might have gotten up while you were gone, and you don't want to get busted walking through the door. So you tiptoe back in there. Yep, she's still asleep. So now I got the beer, and I'm bringing it in the house, and here we go. You can't open this beer in a quiet house at night. You might as well shoot a pistol, right? I don't have a problem with alcohol, okay? But this is how I have to drink it. So you go get a throw pillow off the couch. You put it over the can of beer. You go to the furthest corner away from there. And you, psst. All right. So finally, and here comes the sense of ease and comfort. And I don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous or what they teach us here, but I know what that feeling is. Oh, this is all I've been wanting all day. And so sure enough, so now I sit down, I got the remote control in one hand, I got a beer in the other, and it's like, finally, I can be at peace. And I don't know, you'd get halfway through the second beer, and magically she wakes up, and here she comes into the room, and they all say the same thing. They just look at you and go, what are you doing? You just say, what do you mean, what am I doing? You should just come across the room and let's fight, because there's going to be a fight. So that kind of stuff was happening. I like to think of this too, is, you know, when we talk about the obsession of alcohol, there are two things that kind of go with that definition for me. Number one is I leave work and I have that choice. I don't want to drink. I probably said the night before, I'm not going to drink tomorrow. But something happens and here I am, I'm leaving work, and now it's like, well, I want to drink. But that voice inside me says, no, you can't, you don't want to do this. That's wrong. You shouldn't do this. As I'm driving down the street, and Jan, why do you want to do this? As I'm pull right into the convenience store. Don't do it. You don't want to be this kind of father as I'm walking into the store. Why do you want to be a drunk? Why do you want to be this kind of husband as I'm opening up the door to the cooler? You know, don't do it. Don't do it. But I can't stop myself. I am just driven. There is something going on in my head that just makes me do this. And I haven't been drunk. It's not the physical component. It's just that thing in my mind. I remember I get a 12-pack of beer and get out to my van and pop the top. And I mean, the sense of ease and comfort comes before I even take a drink. Finally. The other definition I like of this obsession is just this. If you call me up and say, hey, Jan, let's go fishing. Hey, Jan, let's go play golf. Hey, Jan, let's go do, doesn't matter. But immediately and instantly, we have to calculate drinking. What is the drinking angle here? Can I drink on the way? Can I drink while I'm there? Can I drink on the way back? How, your drinking has got to be managed when you're an alcoholic like that. It is a part of your life, and you carry it with you all the time, and you have to make sure that you take care of that part of your life. Things were getting bad for me. I didn't want to admit I was an alcoholic, and we had terrible fights. I remember one night she drove me to an AA. I finally, okay, I'll go to a damn AA meeting. So she drives me down to the Turning Point group. I think this is my first time there, and I have to tell you the story that leads up to that. We had been to that, because I get this out of order, but we had been to that wedding reception. I had acted really bad, and I told her I would make it up to her. So I was going to take her out for a nice dinner, and we were going to have a good time. So we go out, and we get to the restaurant, and we have to wait for our table. And so we wait at the bar. She gets a margarita, and I order Jack Daniels and water. And she looks at me like, what? What are you? And I'm like, it's one. It's a drink. It's one drink. Big deal. One drink doesn't hurt anybody. So I drink this drink, and our table's still not ready, so I order another drink, and I get the look again. And it's like, it's my second drink. It's the last one, so knock it off with the looks. I'm not exactly saying that, but I'm thinking that. But this was a good night, by the way. This was going to be a good night. This is the night I found out about the phenomenon of craving. So they get our table ready. We go sit down. My drink is done. And she is sitting there, and she has this much in this margarita that she's drinking. And the thought goes through my head, I need to reach across the table and take her drink. Now, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I'm fairly certain I shouldn't do that. Because I know in my head, if I do that, that sends a pretty clear signal that I have a problem with alcohol if I have to take that drink. And what's more, she's going to know for sure that I have a problem with alcohol. And what's more, I'm going to know I have a problem with alcohol. And she's going to know that I know. And I'm going to know that she knows that I know. And she's going to know that I know that she knows that I know. And all of a sudden, my head is spinning. I don't know what's going on. But you know what I did? I reached right across that table in front of her and took that drink and downed it. Because I had to. Because I had to. So there was a heck of a fight that night. I left her at the Circle K. I told her I had to stop in and get... I left her with the car and the keys. I told her I needed some cigarettes, so I ran into the store, and then I snuck out and just took off so I could go get drunk. I mean, I left her there with a way to get home. I wasn't at least had that going for me. But anyway, that's the thing that drove me into Alcoholics Anonymous the first time. That's when I realized, you know what? Maybe I should do something. Maybe I should go. But she drove me to that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I remember getting out of the car, and I looked at her, and I said, well, this is it. I'm a failure. It's come to this. I got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and be with those people. Because an alcoholic is somebody in a bag. Well, you know, somebody on the street with a bag. It's not me. I mean, I still have a job. And I went in there, and I'm sure I heard a lot of good stuff. I don't remember a whole lot about it. I remember they gave me a big book, and I didn't have to pay for it. They said I could come back. So I went back to that meeting the next week for one reason, to give them the $4 for that book, because the worst thing in my mind was if they thought I was a deadbeat, because I didn't want them thinking bad about me, right? So I went back, and there was a guy in that meeting who asked me if I wanted some help, and I said, yeah, I did, and he talked to me, and he came to my house, and he underlined some stuff in my book, and I thought, okay, I don't know how long I was sober, maybe, I think, 3 weeks, but what always happens to me, and if you're alcoholic like me, I know it happened to you, that thought, the insanity of this disease that runs around in my head said, you know what, Jan, you're really just making too big a deal about that whole drinking. I know you can handle this. It's not that bad. You can have a couple of drinks and it'll be all right. So that's what I do. And, you know, and the fights start again and all this stuff, and we get separated again. And, you know, it's, I remember one time I can't even remember what the big event was, but she was kicking me out again. And I said, fine, I'll go. And this time I mean it. I said these words to her: I will never get sober as long as I'm living in this house married to you. Said that right to her face. And she said, because she had been in Al-Anon, she said, well, guess what? That can be arranged. So I got an apartment. And I was thinking when I got this apartment, you know what? Great. I'm finally going to be good. I am going to be on my own. I'm rid of this, and I can just go on and have the good, happy life that I was destined to have. Now, I don't know about you all, but if you put an active alcoholic in a place where he doesn't have anybody to answer to, how long do you think he's going to stay sober? You know, it wasn't 24 hours. I mean, it was that night that I was drunk. And this started the last gasp for my drinking. And this is where things got really bad. You know, things like we had a son that was born by this time. He never seems to make the story like my daughter did, but anyway, I loved him. She used to say, I want to see the kids. She said, well, one of your brothers has to be with you. I'm like, it's come to that. I have to have somebody supervise the visitation when I see my kids. Because she thought I would drink with them. And I would say, drink when I have the kids with me? Are you crazy? Do you think that I would jeopardize that relationship with my kids and that opportunity? I wouldn't. Of course I got caught. You know, putting beer in a McDonald's cup when we were at the park. And you know, so you just thought I was drinking out of a McDonald's cup. But I was, you know, I got caught doing that, so that's why I had to have supervision with the kids. Shoot, I had a brother over at my apartment when the kids were there, and I had vodka mixed with Kool-Aid. So, and that's what I was doing. But I didn't have a problem with alcohol. I didn't want to do anything about it. Things were going downhill. And it happens to all of us. You know, we get caught, something happens, and we think, I have to do better. So what do? I come up with a new plan for my life. And what's it going to be? I'm going to exercise. I'm going to start exercising. I'm going to get my body right. I'm going to get my mind. I'm going to start eating better, too. And I'll get better. Yeah, I'm going to do this. And so you set out on that course, and I don't know, some time goes by, usually not very long, and you wake up drunk again for the third day in a row and realize, all right, this plan didn't work. And the only problem is some of the options you had before are no longer there, and you have to come up with a new plan, and it's self-help books. I'll try that. Read those. No, that didn't work. I'll go to church. I'll get right with God, and this is going to solve my problem. And I go to church, and well, that didn't work either. I still got drunk. You know, and I'd go to Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes too. I'd go to a meeting, and I'm the guy that at the liquor store, after the meeting, I got the white chip. I'm getting change out of my pocket, and there's a white chip I just picked up. And I'm just feeling like, what is wrong with you? You can't even do this for 15 minutes. I had gone to the turning, or to the Hickory Hill group, and I got sober once for just over 5 months. because I surrendered enough at the time to start working the steps and get a sponsor, and I did steps 1, 2, and 3. I didn't call my sponsor a lot, but I was there, and I did the 90 meetings in 90 days, and son of a gun, that works, by the way. You can stay sober doing that for a little while. I didn't need to do that 4-step, though. I kind of stalled. So anyway, I went out of town on business. I was working. I was not yet 6 months sober. I remember this because out of town on business, I got something to drink, got drunk. I didn't want anybody at my home group to know. So a couple weeks later, I picked up my 6-month chip, and then I just sort of drifted away again. But I just didn't want them to judge me and think I was a failure or think I was less than because I couldn't stay sober. That was the thing that just hurt me the most, just that fear. If you'd have asked me if I was fearful then, I would have said, no, I'm not afraid. We'll get to that later. But at any rate, this is where my life is going. When I wake up in the morning in this apartment, the very first thought I have every day is, when can I drink? What can I do today to manage my affairs so that I can drink? Because that's all I wanted to do. I was lucky enough that with the job I had, I wasn't directly supervised. I'm a field engineer, so I'm kind of working on my own. So I didn't have a lot of, there was no structure. I was allowed to set my hours. And man, I'd drive to a town to fix a machine, and I would fix it, and then I'd call in and say, well, I got to order a part, so I'm going to be down here an extra day. So I just stay drunk for an extra day and then go back. And that's kind of how I hit it. The boss I had at the time, man, I don't know if he's one of us, but he sure drinks a lot. And he liked me because I could sort of hang with him when we all went out as a group. I would be closing the bar with him after everybody else went home. So he liked me, but things were coming to the end. I had to go for my performance review with my boss. And like I said, he liked me, but I was sitting in this restaurant where we were going to meet. It was in the morning. And he walks in, comes to the table, sits down directly across from me and says, I don't know what your problem is, but you better fix it. And he got up and left. And I thought, uh-oh, this is not good. I would wake up in the morning just curled up on that couch, just shaken. I hated my life. You know, the four horsemen had moved in. I just could not, just the terror, you know, of the life I was leading, the frustration of not being able to do anything about it, just bewildered. What could I do? What was to become of me? And the despair, just, you're a drunk, Jan. You're a drunk. I wanted to get sober, but I just couldn't. It just, you know, you promise yourself you're going to do better, and you're drunk by noon because you forgot you were supposed to quit drinking that day. And I didn't have a way out. Except one morning, you know, my wife had been going to Al-Anon, and there was a guy who saw her at a meeting. And he asked her, how's Jan doing? And she said, well, he's out there drinking, so you know how he's doing. Well, he gave her his number and said, give this to him. Tell him when he's ready to give me a call. And that number was sitting on my desk. And I guess I had just enough surrender that day to call him up. And I said, Bill, this is Jan. I'm coming to your home group. I need some help. I need a sponsor. It was easy because I was talking to his answering machine. So the next night, you know, I walk into the Turning Point group, and that girl's there saying she always knew she was going to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. She just didn't know when. And I heard that, and that made a lot of sense. And I got up that night. My wife was actually in that meeting and watched me get up and pick up a white chip. I don't think she was impressed by that. She knew I had done that any number of times before. But for the first time in my life, you know what? I had to go talk to that guy where I left the message on his answering machine. Well, he didn't know anything about a message on his answering machine. I don't know if that was true or not. He said he didn't know. I think maybe it was by design, because I really needed to look somebody in the eye. I needed to look another man in the face and say, I can't do this. I need your help, because this was so out of my nature to admit defeat, admit failure, and admit that I couldn't do anything. But I did that. I said, I need your help. He looked at me and he said, Jan, he said, I know you've been, he said, are you willing to go to any length to get it? And I said, yes, I am. And I really was, because I went there thinking, I give up. I don't care anymore. Whatever they tell me to do, I'm going to do. I'm done. I've had enough. I quit. And he said, let me tell you what I think your problem is. He said, you've been around Alcoholics Anonymous, but you've never been in it. Truer words have never been spoken to a drunk than those right there. You know, because all those meetings I went to, you know, when I was at the Hickory Hill Group, I went to 90 meetings in 90 days, but you think I got there early? No. I mean, I got there right when the meeting started, and as soon as we dropped hands from the Lord's Prayer, I was out the door, because I didn't want to get to know you people. I didn't need you people. I just needed to be there for that, and that was going to be good enough. I did the 90 and 90, and that group met twice a week, and that's enough, right? Twice, two times in a week going to a meeting, that was enough. Well, something comes up, and you can't go to the meeting, and it's a good reason. Well, guess what? The next week, you don't need quite as good a reason to not go. And by the third week, I don't feel like it's a good enough reason. So now I'm only going once a week. And then pretty soon, I'm not even doing that. And so, you know what? Hey, I drink. So anyway, I told him I'd go to any length. And he said, well, here's what you're going to do. You're going to read at least 2 pages in your big book every day. You're going to pray every day. You're going to call another drunk every day. You're going to get a home group. And when you get a home group, you're going to go there 30 minutes early and help them set up. When it's over, you're going to stay and clean up. If somebody in your group needs a ride to the meeting, you're giving it to them. If there's somebody in your group that's speaking somewhere, you're going out to listen to them. And so that's what I started doing. I started doing all this stuff. And don't you know, I stayed sober one day at a time. Here we go. I'm on the path, and I'm doing this stuff. I took little Miss Evelyn to our home group for a long time. You know, went and picked her up and even took a little step stool so she could get up in my van. And, you know, I learned an awful lot from that lady, some of the stuff that she told me on the way to and from those meetings. And that was a godsend in my life, just doing that. I went and I helped set up the meeting, and I was there, and I started working the steps. I didn't have much of a conception of God. You know, the other times that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would read the book, and I would get to the chapter to the agnostic, and I'd just say, well, that doesn't apply to me. I believe in God. I'm cool with that. So I don't even read that. Just skip over it. Just go to that other stuff. But you're listening to all these people talk about it. Well, it's only by the grace of God that I haven't had the desire to take a drink. And I remember sitting in my home group thinking, well, it may be God's grace for you, but for me, it's all this getting to the meeting early and cleaning up and setting up chairs. And that's, to me, that's what it is. So I don't know anything about God's grace. I don't know anything about God. And it hit me that whatever belief I have in God is not mine. It was something that was given to me as a kid when we went to church. I really don't know what I think about God. What do you do in that situation? Well, I went to the book, and in the chapter The Agnostic, when I read it, I found this sentence in there that it says, if you believe or are even willing to believe that there is a power greater than yourself, that upon that cornerstone, the foundation can be built for a wonderful spiritual experience. And that question stuck out to me. Do you believe, or are you just willing to believe, that a power greater than you exists? If you just think about the totality of the universe and everything that goes on, you think, well, yeah, there has to be something to it. So I could go with that. So that's kind of the conception I started with. And then I was working out of town with a coworker, and this guy was a bit of a Bible thumper. Now, I don't have anything against Bible thumpers, but I ended up, and I have no idea why I would tell him the story, because it's not in my nature to show myself to somebody, to allow them to see vulnerability or anything like that. But I happened to tell this guy the story about holding my daughter in the swing and this magnificent emotional thing that just ran through me and how powerful it was. And he looked at me so matter of fact, and he said, Jan, that's how God loves us. And it just floored me. It just floored me. I thought, wow, I know what that love is like. That's something I can really grasp And so that became my conception of God, that there was this ultimate love. And so that's what I went with. I'm doing well. I'm doing all this stuff. You start to think, what does getting to this meeting early have to do with staying sober? Why do I have to go pick up Evelyn all the time and go to meetings? What is that? Really, is that keeping me sober? Well, again, I'm working out of town, and I'm afraid to drink, and I'm studying that book. And I'm reading this story of Jim the car salesman. And in that story, it says, you know, he'd gotten drunk, and they worked with him, and it said, all went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. And I thought, wait a minute, what is it? He failed to enlarge his spiritual life. And I thought, that's really important. How do I need to enlarge my spiritual life? How do I do that? Again, in the book, in Bill's story, page 14, when he said, my friend emphasized the absolute necessity of working with others as he had worked for me. For if an alcoholic failed to enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, that's what it's about. That's what that stuff is about that my sponsor had me doing. He didn't tell me that that's what it was, but that's what I recognized was happening. I'm getting there and doing all this stuff, and that self-sacrifice is helping to keep me sober until the miracle can happen. Again, I did the first three steps, and I knew I needed to do a four-step. Everybody says you got to do a four-step, and I wanted to do a four-step, and I'd meant to get to it, but... Well, the kitchen needs to be cleaned up. You know, there's dirty dishes in there, and that room over there is looking kind of messy. I need to clean that. Once I get that done, then I'll be able to do the fourth step. There's something else I need to do, and I'll get on it tomorrow. Well, I had agreed to go see a guy that was in my home group speak one night, being the fine salesman that he is, I mean, he just carries this message with a lot of passion and verve. And I mean, I'm listening to him, and it hit me. I will never have what he has unless I do this fourth and fifth step. And I went home that night, and I was absolutely charged up and ready to go. And I did that fourth step all that night and all day the next day on Sunday. I put everything on that piece of paper that I could imagine. I called him up, and I was proud of it. I mean, I was like, I just felt like I had conquered something, that I bared my soul on this paper, and I was really proud of it, and I was on fire. And I called him up, and I said, I'm ready to do a fifth step. And he said, okay, let's do it Tuesday night. My wife and I are still separated at the time, so I just left it laying there on the coffee table. And man, the next day, every time I looked at that paper, boy, I hated it. I was embarrassed by it. I didn't have the same feeling as I had, and I was scared to death. But I was committed to the process, and I took it, and I went over to his house, and he started reading my fifth step, and we started talking, and I heard some things that the light went off. I didn't have a huge problem with resentment. I was, as my sponsor said, Jane, you're too busy kicking your own ass. Once I could see my part in something, you know, the resentment went away, and I could find my part in it pretty easy. So the resentments were not that bad. What was bad for me and what I discovered was fear. Just the absolute fear that controls my life without even thinking about it. And it really boils down to this one thing for me most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, it's just this. I'm afraid of what you think about me. And it causes me to act in a way that's not really me. You know what? I'll tell little lies. I'll build myself up. I'll do this. I'll do that just to make you like me. I'll try to be funny. I'll try to be this. I'll try to be that. Because, man, if you don't think I'm good looking enough or smart enough or funny enough or so, then I feel less than. Drinking takes that away. But, you know, we can't do that anymore, so I have to find some sort of relief to this. Geez, I remember sitting in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting one time just thinking, man, damn Alcoholics Anonymous, because I have to feel stuff again. And we don't know how to do that. I haven't done that in years, but now I have to deal with this. And he said some things to me that one of the best ones, he said, you know what? He said, just being Jan is good enough. Just being Jan is good enough. There had been enough speakers who'd come into our home group and talked about how nothing you can do can make God love you anymore, and there's nothing you can do to make God love you any less. And I thought, well, I like that, but you know what? It made sense. Just being Jan is good enough. He created me, and I'm just do the best I can. Man, I tell you what, the next few days, I went home and I did the sixth and seventh step, and I was walking on a cloud. When the book talks about they think the drink problem has been removed, it was a mountaintop experience for me. I walked back into the meetings after that. I mean, I felt like Alcoholics Anonymous belonged to me, and I felt like I belonged to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the other interesting thing that dawned on me years later, you know, when you read in there, why should you do a fifth step? It says, because we feel we may not overcome drinking if we don't. And I think back to all those times I'd come into Alcoholics Anonymous and tried. What was the one difference this time? I did a fifth step. I did a fifth step, and I've stayed sober. Imagine that. The book said so. But you know what? I went on, and I had to make amends to people my wife and I were still separated, and I had to say this to her because things weren't going good. And I said, honey, I don't think I can stay sober unless I'm living with you in the house with the kids. You know, I forget that a lot of times in my talk. I get the first one out about how I can't ever stop drinking as long as I'm married to you, but I forget that one sometimes. But I said those words to her. I don't think I can get sober unless I'm living with you and the kids. We need to get this back together. And so we did. And we decided right then, we're just going to do this one day at a time because I don't know if it's going to work. I don't know what we got. So we started on that path. I kept doing the service work. If you're new in this deal, here's a clue. Stay booked. That's something else my sponsors. Stay booked. Have something to do next Wednesday, next Friday. You know, don't get too far away from it. I got a year sober, and my sponsor took me down to the Harbor House, and he was going to talk, but no, he wasn't. He said, you're going to talk. So I gave my first talk. Well, and then he said, now, this Saturday, you're going over to the Serenity House, and you're going to tell your story over there. And then you're going to do it the next month on the first Saturday. And so for the next 11 years, the first Saturday of every month, I went to the Serenity House and talked to those drunks. I used to tell them going in there, you know what, I don't know if y'all get anything out of this, but I'm going to stay sober. So here we go. And you know, you look back on that stuff and just think, wow, this was a pretty neat deal. I started an AA group at my church. Oh, this is another one. I didn't want to go to church, didn't need to go to church. I found a God of my understanding, and we were doing just fine. But my wife had this idea that we should go to church, and my kids were starting to get, I don't know, 6, 7, somewhere in there. I got sober when my daughter was 4, and this was a couple years later. And I thought to myself, well, you know, how do you want to raise the kids? Do you want to just leave it up to chance or give them some sort of Christian foundation? I thought, well, that's you want to give them something. So, okay, well, we'll go to a church. I remember we went to this church. I didn't like it. She found another one. We went to that. I remember saying, well, if I was going to go to a church, which I'm not, that would be one I would do. But we went back, and I don't know, the next thing you know, I'm setting up chairs on a Sunday, and I don't know, a little while, a year or so after that, I'm leading a small group in my home. I don't know how you get from there to there. It doesn't seem like you should, but you know, just all this stuff starts happening, and it's, church is a big part of my life, and I'm a big part in that church and in the leadership. And I look back at where I was and where I've come to, and it just seems like the most natural progression of spiritual growth that a person could have. And I didn't plan any of that. I just did the next indicated thing, and it led me there, and it all feels good. I got with some guys, and one of my friends has a passion for you know, kids from single parent homes and mentoring. So a bunch of us went to youth villages to become mentors. And I got paired up with an 11-year-old African-American boy. Now, I don't know how this is going to work. I'm going to mentor this boy. I don't know what to do, but we're going to find out some things. So for the next 3 years, you know, twice a month, he and I got together, and I had a lot of fun with that kid. We had some good times. I'm 50 years old, and we had to go to the skating rink, you know, because he liked to skate. But I'm in there in the skating rink with him doing that. We got to go to sporting events and do all that. Some of the stuff he liked, some of the stuff he didn't, but it was a good time. He just, last summer, he got adopted, which is great for him. And it was kind of, I love this. He told me the last night I saw him, he said, finally, I'm going to have a chance at a good life. And man, it just melted my heart. Finally, I'm going to have a chance at a good life. And I had to let him go. I left his name and number, my name and number with him. And is if his adoptive parents want to get together, that's fine. But that's up to them. I don't feel like it's my place to try to get into that. But what a good experience that was. You know, I've sponsored a number of people. Most of them didn't stay sober. A few of them have. A very few. It's just amazing to me. Just the right word at the right time. I don't know how many times that I had enough surrender in me. If I'd have had somebody there at that moment, maybe it would have taken. But I thank God there are people in this program, like Bill, who was my first sponsor, who gave his number to my wife and said, have him call me. You know, there's a guy that I sponsor who's sober today. And he says he got sober because leaving church one day, I said the simplest thing to him, what are you going to do different? And he said, that gave him enough to think, you know, I need to do something different, and he's sober today. I don't take credit for that. It, just the fact that, you know what, the words that we say to people when we're out there trying to do this, when the student's ready, the teacher will appear, you know, just that's just how it works. I have a good life today. My wife and I will celebrate 30 years of marriage in June. You know, from what I told you, that it wasn't easy, and I was telling somebody here, we've actually got into a hard place right now. You know, my daughter is out of the house going to school. My son is 19, and while he lives at home, he's working and getting ready to move out. My wife and I are having to spend a lot of time with each other, and we haven't had to do that in a long time. And you have to get to know them again. And I mean, we are different people than we were before, and it's kind of a hard deal to figure all that out again. So we're working on that. But my life today is so much better than I could ever have imagined, and I owe it to Alcoholics Anonymous. This thing is a miracle. I know the pastor at my church likes to say this. He said, "I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is the biggest movement of the Holy Spirit in our lifetimes." This program, the biggest movement of the Holy Spirit. And I think he may be right. The things that we're doing out here, the people that we're helping, and the relief and the joy that we bring into people's lives. I am so grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be asked to speak, and thank you very much.